One of the challenges that I face is that I am a human. I have days when I don't feel like I have what it takes to do what I feel that I've been called to do. There are days when I feel like I have tried and failed, and other days when I just fail to try. There are days that, well, I feel like a joke that somebody shared with me years ago. A wife comes into the bedroom and stands by the bedside and tells the husband he needs to get up and to get ready for church. And the husband replies, "Well, I just don't feel like going today." He says, "I'm tired. The people there never change. They complain about nearly everything. I'm pretty sure they don't like me, and they're never nice to me. So give me one good reason I should get up and go to church." And the wife replies, "Because you're the preacher." Not only do I know that there are times that I might not measure up to be what I need to be, there are times that, well, I question what it is I believe. Now, I'm not saying I question the existence of God. I don't. I don't question Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection that's meant to pay the price for our sins and defeat our enemy, Satan, and disarm his greatest weapon, death. I don't. Those aren't things I question, but there are other things. I understand, or maybe I should say, here's what I know, that on any given Sunday, there are some who listen to the sermon and they're probably questioning what it is they believe. And most that are here probably are not questioning the foundational doctrines like the existence of God or the work of Christ. But we might be asking questions like, where is God in the midst of my situation? Does prayer really change things? Or maybe we ask questions like, what happens the moment that I die? And there are so many other questions that we might ask about our faith and wonder, what is the real answer? I know this, I have tried to meet each of you where you are with the truth of God's Word. Week after week, sermon after sermon. One author I read this past week used the concept of Jesus sometimes being a hammer used to break a rock, and other times being gentle enough to care for the nearly completely broken. And he writes this. He says, "Preachers face not only a personal and cultural challenge, but the social challenge of great diversity. Embedded in their congregation of saints and seekers are people who listen to the sermons from different spiritual and emotional places with very different needs. On any given Sunday, some might need the hammer to break the rock of unbelief and disobedience, and others need great sympathy or empathy and encouragement because they are bruised reeds, barely standing." And this morning's text tells us that Jesus understands that some of us need a rock hammer and some of us need a gentle gardener. Craig Keener, who I've quoted several times recently in his commentary on John, writes of this passage. He says, "Thomas's skepticism illustrates that, or what disciples would be like without the hope in resurrection. Yet Jesus didn't belittle Thomas or the rest. of the yet not completely believing disciples. He didn't chastise him. Rather, he meets him where he is, and where they are, and us where we are. And with that comfort, we're going to turn to the verses in John chapter 20, verses 19 through 29. So when it was evening on that day, the first day of the week, and when the doors were shut where the disciples were for fear of the Jews, Jesus came and stood in their midst and said to them, "Peace be with you." And when he had said this, he showed them both his hands and his side. The disciples rejoiced when they saw the Lord. So Jesus said to them again, "Peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, I also send you." And when he had said this, he breathed on them and said to them, "Receive the Spirit. If you forgive the sins of any, their sins have been forgiven them. If you retain the sins of any, they have been retained." But Thomas, one of the 12, called Didymus, was not with them when Jesus came. So the other disciples were saying to him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see his hands, the imprint of his nails, and put my finger into the place of the nails, and put my hand into his side, I will not believe." After 8 days, his disciples were again inside, and Thomas was with them. Jesus came, the doors having been shut, and stood in their midst and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Reach here with your finger and see my hands. Reach here your hand and put it into my side, and do not be unbelieving, but believing." Thomas answered and said to him, "My Lord and my God." Jesus said to him, "Because you have seen me, have you believed? Blessed are they who do not see and yet believed." As we see this passage, I want us to see this morning Jesus' love for us in two appearances and one misnamed disciple. And so we have the first appearance, and John says they were together on the night of the first day of the week. They were together. In other words, Saturday had ended in the Jewish concept. It was nighttime, but it was Sunday. It was Sunday, and they were gathered together. They had gone through the resurrection on Sunday morning. John and Peter had been to the tomb. They had come back from the tomb. Mary has brought the news that Jesus has risen from the grave, and she has seen him. And 10 of the 12 disciples are gathered together. They have gathered together in a room, and they are fearful, John says. Now, he says that they're fearful of the Jewish leadership. After all, the Jewish leadership had just had Jesus put to death, and it's not a lot of hidden that it wasn't in secret that these 10 had been followers of Jesus. They had been with him throughout his ministry. They are some of the few who followed him from the beginning through 3 to 3.5 years to his crucifixion. Peter and John had followed him into the courtyard for the trials, and John had followed him to the cross. They were not hiding the fact that they were disciples of Jesus. And so if the Jewish leadership had put Jesus to death, they have reason to be fearful that they might round them up and try to put them to death as well. Because, after all, Jesus had been crucified as trying to make himself to be king, treason. He had been afraid. At least Pilate had enough belief that he might try to lead a rebellion, that he was willing to put him to death. So too might they not be rounded up and crucified because simply they were his followers. And they may be, well, they may try the same thing. And so they're in this upper room, or in this room. John doesn't tell us the location. He says they were in a room. They were together, and they had the door locked. And not just locked, they had a lock, but they also had a bar that they would put across the door so that anyone from the outside couldn't get in, and anyone on the inside had to move the bar to get out. They wanted to be in this room by themselves, and they didn't want anybody coming in. And so it probably means that they also had the shutters that would be used to close the windows closed. You know, we can't think of windows like we have with nice glass panes, but they would have shutters that they could pull closed on the windows to keep people out and things out. And those were probably shut as well, but John says specifically that the door was closed for fear of the Jews. And all of a sudden, in the midst of this, they see the risen Jesus, and he makes a statement, "Peace be with you." Now, you have to remember, if you read your Old Testament, if you know the stories of the Old Testament, when somebody saw a vision of God or an angel, the common phrase was, "Peace. Do not be afraid." And Jesus is making a similar statement to his disciples. Do not be afraid. I guess you have to be fearful to need somebody to say, don't be afraid. Or at least there has to be the possibility of fear. But here we have the 10 fearful disciples gathered in a room, and Jesus suddenly appears to them, and peace, do not be afraid. Peace, be still. And he doesn't say it once, but he says it twice. He tells them to have peace, and then he lets them know for sure that it's him. And then he tells them again, peace. I think that he understood that they were afraid. And it wasn't going to take just one statement of peace. It wasn't going to take just the identification of himself, because he just appeared in the room. Now, we don't know how, but he appeared in the room. And they're afraid. And so these 12, or 10, John says the 12 disciples, but you have to understand that that had become a designation for this group of disciples, because he also says that Thomas wasn't there. So if I do my math right, that makes 11. And we also know from the other Gospels that by this point, Thomas has hung himself, or not Thomas, Judas has hung himself. And so he's not present. And so 11 minus 1 is 10. And is my math okay so far? I just wanted to make sure, because I root for Nebraska, as a lot of you root for Illinois, and we're part of the Big Ten, which I think I counted has 14 teams, soon to be 18. So I just had to make sure my math was right, that 12 minus 2 is 10, okay? We're on the same page. It's much the same way that at one point in time, the Big Ten was 10 schools, and they thought they were pretty good things, so they called themselves the Big Ten, you know, and others followed suit, and now it's soon to be 18 at the beginning of August, I think, if I remember what I read right, that 18 teams, you know, that looks like 10 to me. My math says that's closer to 20, but Thomas or John can say that it was the 12, because it was the way they were recognized, the 12 that had followed Jesus from the beginning, the 12 who would be counted as a group and spoken of in that way for, well, nearly 2,000 years now. We talk about the 12. We also don't know for certain how many others were there. John says that they were gathered together, and he says the 10. But there is a good possibility that on this particular night, when the 10 are together, that you may have Mary Magdalene, who is the one who had been to the tomb and seen the risen Lord and brought that news back to the disciples. Mary, the mother of Jesus, might be there because she had been entrusted to John, the brother of James, at the cross. And it says from that time on, he took her into his house. So there is a good likelihood that Mary, the mother of Jesus, was there. There were the other women who'd been to the tomb. And Luke tells us that there are these two disciples that had gone to Emmaus and run into the resurrected Lord and gone back to Jerusalem and told them of the resurrection. Maybe they were there when Jesus appeared and they got to see him a second time. We know that the 10 were there. They are the ones that are important to John and to us this morning, but we just have to remember they might not have been alone. And we also know that as we look at these 10, that there is some doubt. There is some doubt. They do not believe the message that Mary has brought them, that Jesus has been resurrected from the grave. They've heard the account. They know what it is that Mary claims to have experienced, what she saw, what she heard, what she probably touched, the way that Jesus responds to her. And there's still some doubt in their mind. And then Jesus. Then Jesus appeared. We have this first appearance in the upper room to the disciples. And Jesus appears with the doors locked and the windows likely closed. And we're not told how Jesus gets there. I've always wondered about this, and maybe this is just me, but did he walk through the door? Like the doors were shut and he just walked through them? You know, when I used to do construction and electrical work, I talked about ghosting through walls, and you could ghost through walls until they put the drywall on one side, and then I couldn't do it anymore. I wonder if that's what Jesus did. He just walked through the wall. Or maybe my science fiction side, maybe it was like Star Trek, and he said, "Beam me down, Scotty," and he just materialized in the room. We don't know how Jesus got in the room. All we know is the doors were locked, the windows were shut, and Jesus appeared in the room. And I have to say, either walking through the walls or just materializing there, either one would fit what they'd already seen, what John and Peter saw at the tomb. When they walk in and the grave clothes, the things that Jesus was wrapped up in after his death, were simply there, almost like a body was still in them, but there was no body. And Jesus simply escaped somehow, some way. And just for your, so you know, my brain, I've always wondered where Jesus got the clothes that he was wearing. Just he's crucified naked, and when he appears in the room with the disciples, actually when he appears to Mary, you get the sense that he's got clothes, okay? Somewhere in there he gets clothes, and just me, you all can go back to your regularly scheduled program now. So you have the risen Lord who just appears in the room. And he greets them with his peace, to deal with their fear, and then to prove that he is who he said he was, he shows them his hands. And on his wrists, well, like right there, right where the hand and the wrist meet, where the two bones of your arm come together, where there would be enough there to keep it from simply ripping, the nail from ripping out with the weight of your body on your hands. You see, the Romans wanted you to have a lot of pain and take a long time to die. They wanted to make it awful. We get the word excruciating from out of the cross, Latin, out of cross, excruciating. And Jesus shows them his wounds. And then whatever he's got on for clothes now, he either has to hike up his garment or open it somehow, and he shows them his side, whichever side it was, where the Roman soldier took the spear and jabbed it into his side, and John says the blood and the water came out. He shows them this gaping hole in his side. Now, there is a reason for that, because he's proving to him. He's giving them proof of, first of all, his identity. As he sees them and he says in a greeting that they would understand, peace be still. They know his voice. They know his face. They know him. He's showing them to himself to show his identity. But then he shows them his hands, and they probably could see his feet once they saw his hand, to show that he had truthfully been crucified. You know, these nail scars in his hands and his feet, they weren't fake, they were there, they were real, they could be seen by the disciples. And there was proof of the crucifixion in the nail scars on his hands and his feet. And then he shows them his side, because John says specifically that they knew he was dead, and they could prove it because they stabbed him through the chest, the side of the chest, and the blood and the water came out. He was dead. And Jesus shows them his side to prove that he was dead. And since we know that it was Jesus, since we could see that he was crucified, and we know that he was dead, when they see him, they know that he has resurrected from the grave. Now, I don't know where your locked room is. I don't know where it is that you're hurting and waiting for God. I don't know what the questions are that keep you wondering about what you believe. I don't know where it is that you are wanting God to get a hold of you or to get a hold of somebody else and just make things plain. But as I read this account of Jesus with his disciples on that first night, what I know is that Jesus can meet us in the locked room. But I was contemplating that, and I began to think about the disciples, and I began to think about the fact that we need each other. The disciples, except for Thomas, the 10 of the 12, were there together in this room. They needed each other to embrace, to encourage, to strengthen, to deal with whatever it was they were dealing with. And the writer of Hebrews puts it like this, because we need each other. He says, let us hold fast to the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. And let us consider how to stimulate one another to love and good deeds, not forsaking our own assembling together, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another all the more as you see the day drawing near. And the writer of Hebrews is able to say that, or says that, because we need each other. You see, you don't just come on Sunday morning to hear a sermon to encourage you to live life more the way God calls us to. We don't come to worship on Sunday morning because, well, it's fun and entertaining. We don't come to church on Sunday morning just to be seen. We come to church on Sunday morning because we need to encourage and strengthen one another. And the disciples were together because they needed the peace that they could bring to one another. They needed the hope that they could give one another. They needed the encouragement to go on that they could give one another. And Sometimes Jesus comes to us in the group. Sometimes Jesus shows up to us together. We're in the locked room and we're here together and Jesus shows up. But I also found this to be helpful. Knowing that the resurrected Lord and that he is resurrected and thus defeated death doesn't automatically remove all the fear and make everything immediately perfect. Though one day we trust, he still will make things new and thus perfect. And we can trust and we can know that God will make everything new and make everything perfect, but I think you know, like I do, that doesn't mean every day is going to be perfect. That there are still questions, there are still things that go around in our brain and make us ask what we believe. And so we have the second appearance. Jesus appears to his disciples, and then John brings us from that time to a period where they meet with Thomas and they explain to Thomas what it is they've seen. And Thomas says, "Yeah, I don't believe you. I'm not sure I trust what it is you're telling me." And so Thomas, the second appearance, Thomas is there. It's a week later. It's the eighth day. So it's the second Sunday. You have the resurrection, and then you have the second Sunday, which is the eighth day. And Thomas, who is missing from the first appearance of Jesus, is now present with the other 10 of the 12. And so we have 11 of the 12. And he's there, but in the meantime, when they have told him about this, Thomas, being a little skeptical, says, "Unless I see and touch, unless I can put my fingers in the wounds, I'm not going to believe that it's really Jesus." Now, we don't know why Thomas didn't believe. Was he a little skeptical about everything? You know, maybe he was, the glass isn't half full or the glass isn't half empty, but I'm afraid I've knocked the glass over and there ain't nothing left in it. Kind of pessimistic. And he doesn't believe. Or maybe he's just in so much grief and so much pain, he hasn't figured out how to believe. He hasn't been able to put all of that together, and he knows what the other 10 have said, and it's not that he doesn't trust them, but maybe he can't put the pieces together yet. Have you been there? You know the truth, but you just have a hard time putting it into practice in your own life because the pain is too real. The emotions are too raw. The hurt is too fresh. We don't know. But Thomas, he makes this claim that he won't believe until he sees the wounds. And so the 11 of them are together again. The door is locked. The windows are closed. And just like the week before, Jesus appears in the midst. But this time, John doesn't focus on the crowd. This time, John focuses on Thomas. He focuses on the one person in the midst of the crowd. He focuses on the personal in the midst of the many. And Jesus comes to Thomas. He appears in the room, he looks at Thomas, and he says, "Hey, Thomas, you know what? Here are my hands. Go ahead, put your fingers in. Thomas, here's my side. Go ahead." And you probably can put your whole hand up there, Thomas. Go ahead. And as I was studying this week, I was reminded of John chapter 1. At the very end of John chapter 1, there is an interaction between Jesus and Nathanael. And Nathanael had been sitting underneath of a tree, and he said, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" And when he comes to Jesus, Jesus says, "Thomas," or Nathanael, "when you were still underneath of that fig tree, I know what you said. And yes, I came from Nazareth, and yes, guess what? Something good can come out of Nazareth." Well, he didn't actually say that, but that's the gist of what he said. And here he says to Thomas, "Thomas, I know what you said." Can you imagine Thomas there in the presence of the Lord, and Jesus says, "I care enough about you that I know you. And I saw you when you were hurting and when you were in pain. And yes, Thomas, I know your doubts. I know your fears. I know your shortcomings, but I still love you." He says, "Here they are, touch me." And in doing that, he's saying, "It's okay. You're all right. Everything is going to be okay, Thomas." And Jesus calls Thomas. He says, "Stop unbelieving and be believing." Now, our English translates that much nicer, but in the Greek, it's "stop unbelieving and start believing." And he says this to Thomas, and I guess that's why poor Thomas gets the nickname Doubting Thomas. And I don't think it's fair. I honestly don't. I think this is a misnomer in giving Thomas a nickname. Because guess what? John tells us that the other 10 didn't believe. And besides, I don't want anybody calling me Doubting Rocky because I don't have everything put together and I can't fit all the pieces together. And I'm pretty sure you don't want me calling you Doubting Mike, Doubting Tracy, Doubting Roger, Doubting Karen. Do you? Is that okay? Do you want me to call you that from now on?
You can call worse.
Well, I probably have to, but we're not going there, Karen. And you could insert your own name into the blank. You don't want me to call you Doubting. But we, like Thomas, have our questions. The other 10, John says they were together in the room afraid and they did not believe yet. The only difference is that maybe Thomas asks for a little more than they had asked for or what they had received. Jesus doesn't specifically tell them to touch him in the wounds. And Thomas asks for that. But maybe John just doesn't record that for us, and they did, and they told Thomas that, and that's why he said, "I won't believe until I get my opportunity." But in that moment, when Thomas is there before Jesus, he goes from disbelief to belief, and he makes the greatest Christological statement of the new era of the kingdom of God. He says, "My Lord and my God. You are my master and my God. You are my king and my God. You are my all in all. You are who you claim to be." is what Thomas says in that moment. And as I was reflecting on Thomas, not just the 10, but on Thomas, I began to see that there are times God will show himself to us individually. Now, I'm not saying that we're going to be like Moses and Elijah and we're going to get a great theophany where we get to see the physical presence of God, or even Isaiah in the throne room of heaven, or John on the island of Patmos. But God will show up to us individually in our times of need. Sometimes that's when we're in the midst of the community and we're doing worshiping together, we're doing life together, we're in the community, and then in the midst of that, God shows up to you in your hurt, in your pain, in your unbelief. Because I know he did it for Thomas, and I know from talking to people for 20 plus years of full-time ministry that happens. That I'm preaching along and I'm saying the things that I believe are from God and the truth of God, and somebody after the service says, "What you said touched me." And I'm like, "What did I say? Huh? I don't remember saying that. I wrote the words, but I don't remember saying that." And they say, "Oh yeah." And it's God showing up in the midst of the crowd. Now, I also know that sometimes God shows up for us like he did for Mary when we're on our own and we're in the midst of that pain. But there are a lot of times where he doesn't show up for us alone individually, but he shows up for us alone in the crowd. And sometimes we see it when we're alone. We see it when he answers prayers. When we have a prayer that we have been praying and we don't know what the outcome is going to be, and we sense God answering that prayer. Not always to our liking even, but we know that God has answered that prayer. And we're called to believe. We're called to take the action of God, the showing up of God in private or in public. We're told to take those answers to prayer. We're supposed to take the truth that we have seen and what we've heard, and we are to put it into belief. In fact, John, if I remember right, John, in the last two verses of this chapter that we looked at a year ago, just after Easter, John says the reason that he has written the things that he wrote is so that we can believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that we can have our lives changed, because belief has moved into action. And Thomas says, or Jesus says to Thomas, "Stop being unbelieving and start believing." And then we have our response. There are two responses here. One is to rejoice. The 10, when they see Jesus, they rejoice. They say, "Thank you, God, for what you've done." They're rejoicing for being in the presence of God. We call it worship. You see, it's singing songs together in the morning, on a Sunday morning, isn't just because we want to exercise our lungs and to stretch our vocal cords. It's because we believe in the risen Lord and we want to worship him for what he's done. We rejoice. Sometimes that rejoicing is proclaiming. We take the message and we turn to one another and we share the message of hope and encouragement to one another. And sometimes we're called to take that message outside of the walls of the church. Actually, this is probably more than the other two. We're called to take the message outside the walls of the church and to tell other people, to make it real in our lives so that we have the opportunities to tell other people about what Jesus has done. Jesus appears in a locked room where the disciples have gathered and are in fear. In other words, they do not have it all together. Then a week later, he appears to them again, and specifically to Thomas. And we all face situations where we feel like we're in locked rooms and God isn't anywhere to be found. And we learn that we need each other, and we need Jesus. And sometimes we need Jesus to come in and be like a good rock hammer and knock the edges off. But a lot of times we need Jesus to come in as that good gardener and to put things together. Because, well, it's true that none of us have it together all the time. And at times, none of us have any of it together. And we need each other's encouragement when we don't have it all together. And we need Jesus at all times. And we get the benefit that the 10 and Thomas don't have. Because at the very end, Jesus says, "Blessed are those who do not see and believe." And though we have not seen Jesus, we can believe. Do you believe that Jesus is the one who will meet you in the locked rooms? Let's praise him together this morning.